Welcome to Still Unbelievable, a podcast by Reason Press, where we examine religious claims, especially those made by Christians, and we regularly respond to items that are featured on the podcast, Unbelievable. We embrace dialogue, but as skeptical former believers, we will also criticise unfounded claims and unsupported beliefs. Everybody, welcome to another episode of Still Unbelievable. This time Andrew and I are talking about the much promised, much anticipated, because I'm sure you've all been waiting for it, our kickoff episode on reviewing the Alpha Course. As you may well be aware, Andrew and I are going through the Alpha Course online, which is part of Holy Trinity Brompton's lockdown services to the nation and the world, indeed. So that's what we're going to be doing here. We're bringing on a guest who I think is your first time on Still Unbelievable. Welcome, Darren.
Hello, how are you doing?
Because we've heard you on Skeptics and Seekers a few times, so I think I'm right that this is your first time on Still Unbelievable. If not, then I'm clearly wrong and I'm not doing my job very well, which is always very possible. But before we get into the episode, I'd just like to highlight Andrew's and my other brand, which is Proscenium. There's a fresh episode up there where I'm talking to Brendan Weber, the philosophy guy. We cover a bit of panpsychism and consciousness, which some of you might find familiar in the conversation because we've already had Philip Goff talking about that. So I welcome all your feedback on that particular episode. I enjoyed my conversation with Brendan. I think he's a top chap. Obviously, I'm still not convinced about panpsychism, but that's neither here or there. It was a great conversation. I think that's what's important. I'm partway through editing yet another episode which Andrew and I did with Brian Blaise, and this time we're talking about the wonders of Bayes. So we've got quite a change in step there. So look forward for that episode on Proscenium probably next week, I expect. So that's Proscenium. Tomorrow, Andrew and I are joining David over on Skeptics and Seekers to talk about race. That'll be an interesting conversation because as a white male, I obviously know everything there is to know about race. Sarcasm, in case you didn't pick that. So anyway, that's what's going on. But for here, for right now, we're talking about the Alpha Course. And I'd like to highlight just before we get into that is you're listening to three atheists talking about the Alpha Course and the arguments in the Alpha Course. So let me just get this straight out there. There is going to be criticism and there's going to be quite a lot of criticism. So be prepared for that. If you're okay with that, go right ahead and enjoy it. If you're not quite okay with that, go and get a pen and paper, take some notes and feedback. The email address to feedback to is reasonpress@gmail.com. If you don't think we're being fair to Alpha, I genuinely welcome your feedback and would like to hear that. So this will be the first episode that we do on Alpha. We don't know how many we're going to do yet, but we'll find that out when we've done it all. We won't be doing one for each week in Alpha. That will just be too many episodes, but we'll probably do maybe three, four. We'll just see how it goes. So
one shout out before
Andrew.
You, Crystal. Well, so Tony was going to join us today. So we were supposed to have a fourth voice.
We were, yes.
Here today. Tony was going to join, and I'll leave Tony's last name off and let him decide whether he wants to use it in the future. But he was unable to be with us today due to a migraine, and those things are pretty serious. I'm sorry he couldn't be here. He's a cool guy. He has promised to join us at a future episode in this series on Alpha. And so, Tony, sorry that you're not with us, and we're looking forward to having you on in the next couple of weeks when we address future episodes of the Alpha Course.
Thank you, Andrew. Well reminded. I should have brought that up. So Alpha in general. Now, the reasons for Andrew and I attending Alpha is, well, it was mostly me that led this because for a while I'd wanted to test my aversion to Christianity. As most people know who've heard me talk about my story of leaving Christianity, I left Christianity around about 12, 13 years ago now. And so I've been kind of had a finger in the air looking for an Alpha Course that I could join just to test my thinking, test how I feel about Alpha. And with the lockdown came the announcement that Holy Trinity Brompton, the church in London that where Alpha originates from, were going to be doing Alpha online. I thought, actually, you know what? This is a good opportunity for me to put that test into action. So that's my motivation behind doing this. Going into Alpha, I have some genuine concerns about the quality of argument that I would be faced with. So that was one of the things I was bothered by. I had one of the concerns which I've expressed about Alpha, probably not on mic, is that we all know what the conclusion of Alpha is, and the conclusion of Alpha is that Christianity is true and that the Christian God exists. So my concern from an analytical scientific perspective is, if that's your conclusion and you've got this set of courses which are going to lead up to that conclusion, can I trust that all the steps and all the processes that have gone through to get to that conclusion are exhaustive? How do I know that all those steps aren't a directed path to get me to that conclusion? And some things are left out and some things are included and some things are given more prominence than they deserve. So that is straight out a concern that I'd already called out about Alpha that I'd had a problem with. And I think my specifically, and this doesn't apply to what Andrew and I are doing, but it is a criticism specifically of Alpha, is where you've got youth Alpha, where Alpha is also done for younger people. They've got slightly tailored Alpha for young people. And I've got a concern if that is what's happening, and then you're feeding that same incomplete train of logic, and then you're sending it to young people who are going to believe and trust the adults they're talking to, you know, what questions should we be asking about that? And I very firmly throw that kind of line of reasoning into the indoctrination box. So I consider that to be unhealthy as well. So those are the issues and concerns that I have facing up to Alpha before I even started the first one. Andrew, Darren, are those similar to your thoughts? So is there anything else you want to add to those thoughts?
I do. I think if we just ask the question, what is the default position one should take on a matter about which one has no information, right? So someone comes to me and claims that there's a celestial teapot that orbits Saturn, and we can say certain incantations to the celestial teapot, and the celestial teapot is able to answer and help shape the course of human future, right? What sort of position should one take on that kind of claim? Well, the obvious position is one not of yes or no, but one of I don't know. Because certainly there are, maybe the celestial teapot is a little extreme, right? So maybe we would be slightly more warranted in just saying, I'm not going to give that the time of day. But the actual engagement with the question is what should we think about any claim that is brought to us before we've had an opportunity to study it in depth? And the answer to that is, I don't know. It is to take the position, I don't know. And it bothered me from the beginning with Alpha that there was no attempt to take the question from a point of skepticism, from the point of I don't know. And the reason I say that is Alpha does, at least in the first 4 or 5 weeks that I've been involved with, they've taken absolutely no opportunity. Not once have they taken the opportunity to grapple with any counter-apologetics, something that might oppose Christianity. And for me, what I was hoping for with the Alpha course from the beginning was an actual grappling with counter-worldviews. Why does Christianity make sense? And I didn't get any of that in these first few weeks. And I had really hoped that I would. I'd really hoped that as a skeptic, I would meet Christian skeptics who, through force of good argument and substantive evaluation of all of the literature, became Christians. And that's not what I see.
Yeah, I think I've got sort of the same concerns that Andrew does. It's I'm not sure I was really expecting anything going in, but I was. But given how disappointed I was with the first couple of episodes that I watched, I'm pretty sure I was on some level expecting more than what they were providing. They seem to make. I mean, I'm not sure if you guys noticed this or not, but in the first couple of episodes, they say a lot of what Christianity is claiming, and yet they don't do anything to demonstrate that what's being claimed is accurate or how the world works. And then they just move on from this is what Christianity is claiming to just assuming that this is what's actually true, and then just moving on as if that sleight of hand was okay.
That's right. So sort of 40% or so through the first week's video, and we'll link to the videos for the listeners so that you can evaluate our claims for yourself against the alpha videos. But from very early on, we encounter someone who's a lawyer in the United Kingdom, right? And he says for himself that he evaluated the evidence and he became a Christian. You get more familiar with the bulk of his story as the videos progress, but the basic flaw in the argument for anyone watching the video, and the thing that you should be able to identify as a skeptical listener, is this is just an argument from authority. He's a lawyer. He claims to have evaluated the evidence, and therefore I can trust his conclusions. And I'm sorry, go ahead, Derek.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No,
I was just going to say that, and his evidence, because he goes through the first video is him saying, oh, he examined the evidence is so great, and then we find out what the evidence is in week two.
Right.
And the evidence is that he read the New Testament. And
right.
I paused there because that's it. He read the New Testament, right, and he decided it was true. That's the evidence that that he said, all this evidence that he examined. He even gave an example of a judge with a well-read Bible, and then said he had examined the evidence as well fairly thoroughly because, you know, apparently the Bible is the evidence.
Right.
Yeah, that's good. And there, I've got a specific point I want to make on episode two. But before we start, we dive and start talking about specifics of those first couple of episodes, there's a couple other things on the more general topic of alpha that I'd like to talk about. And that's the format of what's going on. So the format generally is it's a Zoom call. Other brands of video conferencing are also available. And we meet together at a set time of the week. For me, it's Wednesday evenings. And there's about a dozen of my, although the number has fluctuated from week to week. And we chat for about the first 15 minutes. It's just general chat. How was your day? Hello, people. Good to see you again. You know, someone tells a funny anecdote, etc. Comment on people's backgrounds, etc. Then we watch the video. And the videos vary in length. They seem to be getting a little bit longer as each week goes on, but it's gone from about 25 minutes up to about 32 minutes. So that's kind of the length of video. And then we've got questions and discussion on the video topic afterwards. And obviously that varies on the quality of the leader and the people on the call. And there's usually a leader and a co-leader on each call. So that's two people on each call. And mine are two ladies, and I think they do a very good job of guiding discussion and asking some really good questions. But there's a point that I'd like to pick up that was made when it was announced when Alpha was going online. And I know Justin Briley on The Unbelievable Show mentioned this, that there's been a huge uptake of people. And isn't this fabulous that all these people are showing an interest in Christianity during the lockdown? Well, I'd like to put some context on that. So on my Alpha course, and Andrew, if you can give us a little bit of a breakdown on the demographic on yours without specific identities. Obviously, we have no intention of identifying any individuals on any of our courses. Just get that out the way open. There's, like I say, there's about a dozen, although not every individual has been on every week. I'm the only out and out atheist. There is another person on it who calls, they describe themselves as agnostic, but they're almost in the same place as I am, in that they're unconvinced by Christianity, and they and I tend to agree on almost every point. There's only small points that we disagree on, but when it comes to the critique of Christianity, we both tend to agree. But out of the dozen, you've only got the two who are actually questioning Christianity, or the others of some level or other, whether it's the leader or somebody who might be called a fringe Christian, all the others have an investment in Christianity of one type or another. I think there's one person who comes from a Catholic background and is investigating Christianity a little bit more from a Catholic perspective. And there's probably three, maybe even four people who actually go to Holy Trinity Brompton Church in London. So when you look at that demographic, in terms of those who are showing an interest in Christianity, it's not actually looking great for the demographic on my particular course. How does that match with yours, Andrew?
That's an interesting question, because when we join the large group at the beginning, every Wednesday morning, I get up and I get up at 4:30 for my 5 o'clock alpha course every Wednesday morning. But the large group, there's about 35 of us, I guess. That's 10 o'clock in the, yeah. Well, it's 10 o'clock in the morning for London time, right?
Right.
And then we break out into small groups. And my small group has somewhere between 9 and 12 people, and it does fluctuate a little bit week to week. But in my particular small group, I am the only atheist. And as a result, I end up as the conversation piece each week, and that's fine, because the group leader, to give the group leader credit, I don't think he would mind me using his name, but I won't because I haven't asked him. To be fair, the group leaders have been pretty well trained to handle these meeting interactions. And so if the conversation starts to turn acerbic, he steps in and he's very adroit at keeping these conversations professional, if you will, right? So it's well conducted, but the people that I encounter are people that are all Christians. In fact, we've even got people that have their own ministries in my group, from 9 different countries represented.
Really?
Above.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's been an interesting experience, but the sorts of what I see on a week to week basis is just Christians who want to come and tell their own stories. And this was something that happened last week that really amused me. So we have a Christian from, I don't actually remember because it's one of 9 countries and I don't keep them all in my heads, but it's a country that, doesn't have great internet access, et cetera. It's, a poor country. And this person is from a Christian tradition. Just, I kid you not, folks, a Christian tradition that includes voodoo.
Interesting.
Well,
see, now I come from a Christian tradition that would reject voodoo straight out the bat.
But Christianity is really good at incorporating all the other traditions it encounters.
Right. So here was the way this was used. The group leader actually incorporated this Christianity. He's in London. He's part of the whole HTB team. But he used this dark, so I'll just use his phrase, dark spirits, as a way to combat a certain kind of atheist objection that I forwarded, having to do with, so I suggested that prayer only works at about the level of chance, and sometimes worse, and that we have studies about prayer that indicate that prayer only works at about the level of chance. And so I was asking the question, why should I care about the Christian message when the tools that are supposed to prop up the Christian God don't seem to work beyond a coin flip, right? And he used this Christian's story that includes voodoo and says, well, you know, in some countries that aren't as well developed, they encounter dark spirits much more often. And then the conversation moved away. And so if you're sitting there wondering, why isn't there more to the story? Well, because none of us get a lot of time to speak every week, right? So the conversation moves on. But that's a pin in the map for next week. What will I have to say about these dark spirits that are encountered, in countries that aren't well developed, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been a strange journey, the Alpha Course, at least in my small group, because there's such a wide range of people and influences and the types of Christianity that are trying to be adopted into the tent in our group conversation. So
if we extrapolate that out, we could possibly account for between 30 and 40 people between our two groups on.
Yeah.
And of those, let's say 30, because it makes it easier for them. Of those 30, three are non-Christians, or the others are professing some form of Christian theist belief. And of those three who are non, two of those are interlopers there to dig a hole in the dike.
By the way, I was honest. So Matthew, you and I talked about what would happen if someone recognized one of us through their podcast travels, right? And so from day one, I let my group leader know I'm an atheist. I podcast about these things, and my podcast partner is also doing the Alpha Course, and that we would in due course be talking about the Alpha Course experience. So they know that I'm out. They know who I am.
Okay. I've expressed that I'm a podcaster. I haven't said that I'm going to be analyzing Alpha, but one of the I think it was the co-leader on my group did say to me this week, says, I found your podcast, Matthew, and I started listening to it. And so she started listening to the latest one with Brian Blaze and Jonathan McClatchy having a conversation. And she said she struggled to engage with it a lot because a lot of it was very technical. And so she didn't quite get all of it and she fell asleep. So we had a bit of a joke about our podcast sent someone to sleep. So, but there we go. So Darren, hearing that, what's your response to hearing the demographic description that we've given and how it compares to the apparent excitement of Christians, that Christianity has become really, really popular over the lockdown?
I am completely unsurprised. Didn't the Richard Dawkins Foundation do a poll at some point and found like something like half of the people that claim to be Christians in the UK don't actually believe the mythology? They're just like cultural Christians.
Potentially, that's not ringing a direct bell on that, but that wouldn't surprise me. Yeah, there's lots of different Christian traditions and. In my life as a Christian, I encountered a few, and there are some differences of opinion on the small group of Christians that I am on certain elements, which we can get to. So, yeah, I have no difficulty whatsoever accepting that that's probably true.
Yeah, well, I guess my real question, though, for you both is, given that like 99% of the people on that you're working with are Christians of one form or another, how many of them are actually finding the arguments provided satisfying?
I risk being unkind to some of them if I answer how I truly feel. That sounded so duplicitous, didn't it? I'd like to apologize to any listeners who felt that that's what I think that there are certainly some of them who are uncritically accepting what the video says and then what some of the more mature Christians in the group say is my honest gut feel from some of the participants. I don't know what they think about me being throwing in questions and challenges to things that are being said, but I kind of feel that there's certainly some which just accept what's being said uncritically.
That's largely, I think, my experience as well. And to be fair to some of the skeptical objections that I offer, some of the skeptical objections took years for me to come to terms with. Why is this a good objection? Why should we care about that objection? And so one of the objections I've made recently had to do with historical evidence for the resurrection. So I offered this in the group. I simply pointed out that the tools of history don't allow for us to determine whether a miracle occurred, but only whether a person or group of people thought that there was a miracle. The clear point being that there's no amount of historical investigation that you can actually do to find out whether a person was in fact resurrected from the dead versus a bunch of people just simply thinking that they did. And Christianity has a long history of rejecting resurrection claims other than the Jesus claim. Well, why is that important? Because they all depend on the tools of history, right? Now, when I offered this objection, I say all of that to say this. When I offered that objection, what I got back on that week out of three of the Christians who chose to address my objection directly was, well, they had examined the historical evidence and they believed in the resurrection. And so you're not actually grappling with how you got history to get over the hump to prove that a miracle did in fact happen versus one where people sincerely thought that it did, but they were mistaken. Right. And so I think to Matthew's point, there's a lot of non-critical acceptance of these stories. And, you know, I don't expect much more going forward, to be honest.
Does that answer surprise you, Darren?
Not really. I don't know. It's because I've been sort of in the looking at Christian claims for like 15 years now. It's sort of been, it started sort of with my first degree and then sort of became a hobby after that. And I don't know. I was never indoctrinated as a child, and I just have never on a gut level figured out how people actually come to believe in this kind of thing. Maybe it's that old saying that, you know, you teach someone one religion and they become indoctrinated, and you teach them lots of religions and they become inoculated. Because, you know, I really enjoy, you know, Egyptian mythology, you know, especially the old world stuff, Book of the Dead. I love Greek mythology and Norse mythology, and it all just sounds the same to me, especially when Christians start making their claims. And it's maybe that's why I just don't get it.
So maybe it's useful at this point to sort of expand what you're talking about here, Darren. What does skepticism mean in terms of, so you reject old Egyptian myths and religions. What would it take for you to accept Christianity as more valid than some ancient Egyptian religion?
Evidence, really. The problem is that when Christians say evidence, they're not saying the same thing I am when I say evidence. When a person can say they read the New Testament and that's the evidence they're examining, I just can't follow them there as that's actually evidence.
If someone came back from a visit to Egypt and they went into one of the pyramids and they say that they saw one of the cat statues, because we all know the Egyptians love their cats, come to life and bound about the room and then get returned to its position, would that not convince you?
I don't know. Is Bast actually talking to them? Is it giving them any like real information, or have they smoked any magic mushrooms before they went into the tomb? I mean, what are the criteria we're evaluating here?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, where Cat is civilization. I think so. but that's actually the kind of thing that I did want to chase, because it ties in a thread that Matthew, I don't know if this is common in your group, but my group, even when some problem like textual criticism comes up and the Bible is shown to be unreliable, what gets brought up is personal experience, and this happens every week without fail. I bring up someone like Bart Ehrman or Christopher Hitchens Richard Carrier. Sorry. So bring up someone who's done some real digging in counter apologetics, and the objections almost don't matter. You can demonstrate that Ehrman has a good point, or that Carrier has a good point, or Hitchens has a good, and it doesn't matter because they all fall back on personal experience. And I'm wondering if you have that same sort of tendency in your groups.
Not really. I don't think. I think you probably bring up more intellectual challenge than I do. I tend to go more the logical, evidential approach rather than the reporting of what other people said. So no, there isn't quite to the same level in my group.
So how do you think your group gets on with deciding that the history of Christianity is better than the history of Egyptology? How do they carve that out? How do they rationalize?
That's a really good question. I should probably try and ask something like that. I think I've only got 2 weeks left before it winds up for me. Mm. But that's a good question. I should probably ask something like that. But I think that kind of ties into week two, and I don't want to land there just yet. So before we loop in on that, I'd like to pick up some feedback, because I've announced that we're wanting to do this, and we did get some direct feedback. And the feedback was, would we be investigating anything about the finances behind Alpha? And I don't think it's possible to do that to any real detail without Freedom of Information requests and stuff like that. And I just haven't even bothered looking into how that could be done. But I'll just sketch out a little bit of what I know and stroke have been able to, I think, in work out or guess. And happy for you to weigh in. Certainly, so if we rewind Alpha 20, 30 years, whenever it started, the way Alpha would be run is each churches that would run an Alpha course would buy their materials from Holy Trinity Brompton, who would obviously publish all the printed materials, and you'd get books which you would give out to each participant on the Alpha course, and there'd be a video, and then it became a DVD that would be played at the Alpha course, and to a greater or lesser extent there'd be able to be some reuse across those. But obviously where you've got those physical materials, those would be bought from Holy Trinity Brompton, and the churches that would run an Alpha course would do that at their own cost. It would come out of their outreach budget. But I don't think per church, per group, that actually was a huge amount of money going back to Holy Trinity Brompton. So under that capacity, I genuinely don't think that made Nicky Gumbel a wealthy man, or even the church a wealthy church. If somebody has any information that shows me wrong on that, by all means bring it forward. But I genuinely don't think that amounted to huge amounts of money. It could be that the sheer numbers that they printed around the country, and I really don't know how many were sold, but when it went global, maybe there were millions of copies of these books being sold. And if there are a couple of pennies profit per copy, so multiply that by a million, it comes like that. By that point it will come. But if that's the kind of money that we're talking about, I don't think I particularly have an axe to grind on that kind of thing. But But doing it now and doing Alpha now online, there's almost zero cost because we're watching it on video. So obviously there's cost in terms of a Zoom subscription and there's server fees. But you know, when you roll that out across the groups being run, you know, the cost, it's going to cost Holy Trinity Brompton to run each of these groups. They're not going to make any money out of running these. How it works, if it's syndicated to other countries, is anybody's guess. But with the internet the way it is, again, it's probably just the same. It probably costs Holy Trinity Brompton for each group, but I doubt it's very much money. And the way churches do it now is they do it online as well. When I say now, I mean pre-lockdown churches were doing it digitally anyway. So again, they weren't buying materials from Holy Trinity Brompton. So in recent years, I think the income from churches doing Alpha was probably reduced to effectively zero and maybe even a loss. What I suspect, where if there is any income from Alpha, it comes from not from churches and individuals doing it, but from their tie-in to rehabilitation projects. Because on some of the videos, there's people who've been in prison who have given a testimony of doing Alpha in prison. And I suspect, again, I've not actually tried to confirm this, and if anybody has any more detailed information than what I have at my guess, then please feed that back to us, reasonpress@gmail.com. I suspect that what's happening is prisons will have some kind of rehabilitation budget for prisons. At least I hope prisons have rehabilitation budgets, which they spend. And some money from that budget will presumably go to people who are trained to deliver Alpha, and that will go presumably to the church rather than to the individual as a supplying organization, and they will send people and they'll be paid for the time that they do to send people into the prison and to run an Alpha course. I have no idea what kind of fees we're talking about on there, but rolled out across the UK, however many prisons we've got. Again, it's going to be anybody's guess. I don't know. I don't think it's going to make the church millions of pounds per year, but it's probably large enough that they'd notice it on their bottom line. But that could be a few thousands or a few tens of thousands. But it does also go to other countries across the world as well. In the video from the week that I've just seen, there's testimony from somebody who did Alpha in prison, I think in Nigeria. So it does go across the world on that. So I think if there's any income coming into Alpha now, I think it's from that, from rehabilitation budgets. And I guess there's a genuine question there about, is this any good? Is this a useful and efficient, cost-effective method of spending money to rehabilitate prisoners? Are there better, more reliable, secular methods of rehabilitation prisoners that will produce better value for money? I don't know the answer to that question. I'm putting it out there as a question. If anybody has any thoughts or answers on that, give it a go. I'm uncomfortable with this kind of proselytization to a captive market on prisons, specifically prisons abroad, where there's less freedom to say no to things like this than there would be in the UK. That bothers me and concerns me, especially with the aforementioned criticisms of Alpha not being a balanced critique, and it's actually guiding people to a specific conclusion. So that's enough of me. Thoughts from you two on what I've just said? Any additional information to add to that?
Go ahead, Darren. I'll follow you up.
Okay, I was just going to say that they're probably making quite a bit of money from their Amazon affiliate links. The little Amazon link underneath each video that leads to one of the books.
Okay, you think at Amazon there's some trade back from Amazon, some sort of like section of Amazon's profits on that for the link back?
Amazon affiliate program.
Okay, yeah, all right then.
Yeah, and not only does it apply to the book, but it applies to whatever else anyone happens to buy while they've got that cookie in their browser.
Oh, really? Okay, interesting.
Yeah. So if you do all your grocery shopping at the same time you're buying a book recommendation through HTB, they don't only get a profit on the book, they get a profit on all the groceries that you bought at the same time.
Oh, okay.
But there's another bit of this. HTB doesn't only do the Alpha course. There's a lady in my group that also does their divorce counseling bit, their marriage counseling. And that's entirely separate from Alpha.
Yes, they do that. I'm aware that they do a marriage course as well. I actually did it with my wife 20 years ago.
All right. So you've got better information on the course than I do, but I'm sure that, you know, depending on whether you think they worked for you or not, you know, couples might.
Well, we're still together.
Yeah, but did that work for you? I don't think you're still together, but are you happy? No. So I'm kidding. That's all tongue in cheek. And I know you're happy and tell your wife I was only kidding. But my point is only that I think couples that would go through counseling would probably also give to HTB, you know, even if they didn't buy the material because it's being done online now or whatever, there's probably a bit of passing around the gift basket, you know, a follow-up email or something like that. Well, you've been taking this marriage counseling stuff with us. How did it work for you? And remember, HTB is a nonprofit, and, you know, how much did you make last year? Send it in. Or something like that. So I'm sure they get donations, goodwill donations, not only through Alpha, but through their marriage counseling and all of that kind of thing.
Okay. Any other thoughts on that and finances? But that was a good shout, that, Darren. That just hadn't occurred to me about those links underneath the video.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I pay attention to just because I've been thinking about doing some of the Amazon affiliate stuff myself. So top of mind type of thing.
Okay. We're clearly missing a trick there with this podcast, Andrew. We should probably look into that ourselves.
We should, yeah. You know, and then five people once a year can send us 30 cents or something.
If it buys me a bottle of Kahlua once a year, I'd be a happy man.
Yeah, it's actually going to be a little bit more than that, just because with the affiliate links, you make more than you do with like the advertising. You make a lot more than you do with the advertising. Advertising is like, you have to have like 1,000 or 2,000 to actually start making money a day. Affiliate links, you can make $2 or $3 per purchase. So.
Okay, Matthew, we need to explore affiliate links. There you are.
Yes, side note on that, because Andrew and I have not made any efforts whatsoever to monetize either of our brands. We're doing it at cost to ourselves at the moment. We just enjoy doing it. We know we have been contacted by people wanting to donate to us. We've said, give it to a charity of your choice. We're not monetizing at this moment. It might be something we look to in the future, as you've just got from the last couple of minutes, but it's not something we're actively trying at the moment. One more thing I'd just like to pick up on, this thing about rehabilitation, etc. And we talked about this briefly off mic before we started this, and I saw a news story today about, and Andrew, you can tell me if this is something that you think is a feature in America, because I just don't think it'll be tolerated in this country. At least I hope it wouldn't be tolerated in this country, of an atheist who was in prison and who declined to attend as part of his rehabilitation for his prison sentence, an overtly Christian counseling session, which involved a commitment to prayer. And I can't remember what all the other details were. But anyway, he was offered this overtly Christian course as part of his preparations. I can't get my letters out today. Anyway, as a result of him declining that, his probation officer basically effectively cancelled him his probation. He was back in prison for 6 months effectively for refusing to attend Christian classes. And that has got to be counter to whichever, is it your First Amendment rights in America, or one of them anyway? I don't think that sort of thing will be tolerated here in the UK, but I was disappointed to read about it in the US. Do either of you want to comment on that?
Yeah, it is definitely, I forget which one it is, but it's definitely unconstitutional. The separation
counter to the Establishment Clause. That's right, yeah. The Establishment Clause.
Yeah, but with the current Supreme Court pick that Trump just put in, the
Kevin Kavanaugh.
Yeah, the chances of our church and state separation staying stable over the next 50 years is very slim.
Yeah, I think that's right. As I recall, I read this story a while back, but as I recall, this particular This particular parolee was actually a member of the bar. He was a lawyer. He got mixed up in something that got him into jail. And that's how he ended up pressing this. So this ended up going to court because he was a lawyer. I don't know how such things work after you get out of jail. Maybe he'll get his law license back or not. But he was a member of the bar, and he didn't like that he was being forced to participate in a Christian program as part of his rehabilitation. And I think at the moment, this is still somewhere in appeals court territory. And if I can look it up before we get off mic, I'll say something about it in my close. But this is a clear violation of the Establishment Clause and of his right to practice religion or not to practice religion as he sees fit, because the United States doesn't have a state-sponsored religion, well, except Christianity, apparently. But yeah. So there.
And I'd just like to make it clear that at time of recording, I have no idea if it was Alpha that he was invited to participate in. I don't know that, but we do know that Alpha is involved in prisons, but we don't know that this particular case involves Alpha. But what I would hope is that the people that are involved with responsibility and leadership at Alpha would reject being associated with this kind of case. I hope that is the case. But like I say, I don't know the facts regarding Alpha regarding this case. With that said, so specific episodes. So Darren, you've watched the first two episodes. Andrew, videos, that is. When I say episodes, I mean videos. And Andrew, you've attended the first four courses now. Thoughts on what you guys have seen so far in the early episodes? I know we've covered a little bit of them, but any standout moments for you, either from the videos or what's been talked about?
I think what stands out most for me is that they are very careful with how they word things, which sort of is a red flag for me that a lot of this is premeditated. So far, their pattern seems to be Christianity claims this. Christianity makes this claim. Jesus claimed to be God, that kind of thing. And then they do this sort of sleight of hand trick where they go from Christianity claims this to just assuming that what Christianity is claiming is true, and then moving on from there. And that just seems very deliberate to me and not very honest, quite honestly.
The biggest standout moment for me, I think, is week three. That's the forgiveness week, if I remember correctly. And so there's this big conversation about Jesus and him accepting all the sins of the world and having the capacity to forgive. And at least in my small group, the 9 or 12 of us that show up on any given week, that message is a really confused message inside Christianity. There was not a good defense of substitutionary atonement. For any listener that doesn't know what that means, it's not a particularly technical phrase, but Jesus being able to intervene on our behalf and forgive us of wrongs that we did to others. And I pointed out in that particular week that I thought that was an incredibly immoral position to take, that I thought Christianity was dead wrong in its acceptance of substitutionary atonement, because if ethics mean anything, one of the things that ethics has to mean is that an individual takes responsibility for the things they do. And so if I wronged Darren, you're welcome to say just being here is wrong, you know, okay. But you did
make me do the Alpha course.
Okay, that is a substantial harm. I'm sorry, but Matthew can't forgive me of that on your behalf or on my behalf. right? So, and depending on the flavor of Christianity that you adopt, whether you're very conservative or very liberal, Jesus might forgive one or both transgressions, right? So, might forgive one or both of us. So you couldn't forgive both of us because you didn't do anything wrong, but Jesus might be able to forgive me on your behalf, or whether you forgave me or not, right? But he can accept that wrong for me. And no matter how you carve that, no matter which kind of Christianity you use to think about substitutionary atonement, it doesn't make sense for some Jesus to be able to accept my wrongs, for me to pray to Jesus to take away this wrong that I did to you. And the return story in my small group was a very confused, not particularly even interesting defense of substitutionary atonement. And wow, even my discussion of that was as confusing as the as the week itself. So there it is. But substitutionary atonement in itself, I think, is a big problem in Christianity, that Jesus has the capacity to adopt my wrongs somehow. And that was a particularly confusing week. So, Matthew, I don't know how you guys handled substitutionary atonement. Was it an interesting week?
I don't think that got discussed much, to be quite honest. At least if it was, I don't recall much conversation on it, because what I've been looking for specifically from Alpha is something that I can analyze, you know, something I can get my teeth into scientifically, that and call evidence and wrestle with what that evidence suggests. That's has been my hope from Alpha, that I can analyze that, because that's the way my brain works, is I want to see evidence, I want to analyze evidence, I want to see something that I can properly discuss the merits of a particular interpretation of what's happened in reality, or even argue about whether it did happen in reality. And so from that perspective, I have really, really been disappointed by what Alpha has provided on that particular subject, because there's just been so little of it, and I'm quite frustrated that what I'd hoped for just hasn't been met at all. We're going to be talking about later episodes, obviously when we record later we're just focusing on the beginning, but it sets up a couple of bits at the beginning. I'm going to pick out one little specific example in a minute, but it talks a little bit about evidence and science, and, you know, do the claims of Christianity contradict science, and John Lennox is rolled out in one of the early episodes to answer that particular question. So you've got that treat coming, Darren, as I know you're going to be looking forward to that. And then it very quickly rolls into what things are accepted by Christianity. So it talks about prayer, talks about what Jesus' resurrection means. It talks about reading the Bible, and it talks about the work of the Holy Spirit. And it very quickly moves into those core Christian evangelistic topics, and having very, very lightly touched evidence from a great distance with a really long pole, it then moves on, assuming that you've just accepted that Christianity exists. So I've been really, really disappointed by that. So what do I want to talk about as a specific example? In terms of evidence, the high point is week two. And so in terms of evidence, it's downhill from there. And in week two, the thing that it rolls out, and I raised this specifically in the groups, it talks about textual criticism. And it talks about the textual criticism analysis of the Gospels, and how we can be fairly confident about the age at which the Gospels that we have were originally written. And what the argument, what it specifically says what it suggests in the video, because it doesn't explicitly say, what it suggests in the video is, because we can be confident about the age of the documents and what they say, therefore what they say must be true. And that's not what textual criticism does. Textual criticism, all that does is that enables you to tell you that later translations and later copies are a certain percentage accuracy of the earliest originals that we have in whatever language they are. All it is a validation of what the documents say. There is nothing whatsoever in textual criticism that affirms the truth of what those original documents say. And this is a very important point to hold with textual criticism. And the week two video does not even suggest that whatsoever. It jumps straight to the assumption that what the original documents say must be true. And from there, it leaps into all of the Christian evangelical points. So that was, for me, the biggest disappointment, but and the only point at which I was able to really wrestle with a specific claim that I can talk about evidence. And from there onwards, I've been disappointed. That was a big sigh there, Andrew.
Sorry, I I am. It had nothing to do with you, and I thought I was on mute. I've really got to sort out this binary switch thing, this on mute, off mute. Got to work on that for the next podcast. So, I had the same problem with textual criticism in week two, and that was part of the sigh, is that some of our best textual critics like Bart Ehrman and Carrier but even people like Richard Baca, who are Christians, have real reservations about exactly how serious to take things like the red letters, for instance. So there was an unbelievable podcast between Richard Baca and Bart Ehrman, and Richard Baca is quite willing to say that the Sermon on the Mount, for instance, so that's Matthew 5, 6, and 7, for those who aren't familiar enough with the New Testament to figure out exactly what we're talking about. This is the Beatitudes and the Lord's Prayer and all of that jazz. Richard Baca, as a Christian and a textual critic, is quite happy to say that it simply never happened that way. Jesus never delivered a sermon from a mount that was Matthew 5, 6, and 7, right? And so to your point, Matthew, there are certain things that textual criticism doesn't do, right? And one of the things that it doesn't do is affirm any truth claim. It can't affirm a particular truth claim in any way other than we have these documents that are reliable based on our ability to date the document back to some period and its agreement with other documents that an event took place. So if we had lots and lots of copies of a false claim, textual criticism wouldn't necessarily be able to determine exactly that it was a false claim.
Yeah.
So sorry for the sigh. It was my frustration with week two, not with you.
No, I get that.
Well, the biggest problem with the textual criticism, as Andrew was pointing out, is that the word reliable is in there. And that is what causes the confusion, I think. Because when a historian says reliable, they don't mean that the text is actually true, which is what the Christian hears when they hear reliable. All the historian means when they say reliable is that the text is within a certain margin of error thought to be the same text as was originally written down. And I think that's where the confusion comes in. I think that's why apologists are so able to create that confusion. It's because of that one word.
And we should have a certain amount of built-in skepticism to claims like, oh, Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus, right? If Christians heard that kind of story, no matter how reliable in another religious tradition, there are lots and lots of copies of this story, the story seems to be transmitted accurately in the sense that that this is a reliable reliable record about what people thought happened, right? No one would accept a conversion to Buddhism or to Islam or to, well, Mormonism, right? And the reason they don't is because it doesn't fit with their particular preconceived notions about what God is. And so we should just use the same lens of skepticism for religious claims in textual criticism. Why would we think that something as preposterous as Jesus speaking to Paul on the road to Damascus through some bright light was actually an event that occurred versus something that is more easily explained by hallucination or some sort of brain malfunction that we can talk about pretty sensibly today because we know what they look like, but we don't have Paul's brain, right? We don't have this guy to sort of do a biopsy and see what might have been wrong. But the point is that textual criticism can't say that Paul had that experience, and our natural skepticism should lead us to think that he did not. So, there you are.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'm just looking at my notes from week two, the other thing that I drew attention to from the week two video, and I think it must be towards the end of the video, where they're talking about alternative hypotheses to the resurrection accounts, where, and this is a common Christian apologetic, and because I encountered it many, many times when I was a Christian, is the resurrection must be true because all these other ideas can't be true. And the ideas that they roll off are what's called the swoon theory. Jesus didn't really die on the cross. He swooned and then woke up later, or the disciples carried the body, but that doesn't work because they all died proclaiming that he was risen. But if they knew that he was dead because they carried off the body, then they wouldn't die proclaiming that it was risen. So all these ideas come out. The problem with all of these counter-hypotheses that are raised by Christians to try to shore up that the resurrection really happened, none of them are things that non-believers are actually saying. In the more than a decade that I've been atheist, I have not encountered a single person who genuinely believes any of these alternative hypotheses are what really happened. They all think something else. And so what's happening here is, in order to shore up a myth, more myths that don't fit with the existing narrative are invented in order to be knocked down, to be able to elevate the more likely of the myths to be the truth. And that's just not how you determine the probability of an historical event happening.
Yeah, and they haven't even bothered to show that the original myth that they're promoting actually happened.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that bothers me, is there are alternative stories that Christians like to try to paint skeptics into about the empty tomb, the swoon theory, the twin theory. There are a couple of others that are popular. Well, in order to get me to try to defend one of those, what you're actually saying is that I have to accept the New Testament story as it's written. And I will just go on record and say, I don't care how many graves you find empty. That's not the salient point. And if there was a Jesus and it happened exactly as it was written in the New Testament, finding an empty tomb is not interesting. What would be interesting is demonstrating not only that someone had the ability to be resurrected, which in the cosmic oatmeal cookie sense isn't too surprising. Now, 3 days would be quite surprising, but you'd have to demonstrate that he was dead for 3 days, right? And we do have resuscitation methods, even very old ones. And so the more interesting bit would be showing that there was a resurrection and an ascension. And there is no sense in which an empty tomb can show either one.
Yeah, see, and for me, even if I had to defend the swoon theory or the twin theory, that's still, even as unlikely as that might be, it's still more likely than a magic god that magically raised someone from the dead existing.
Right. And then he transported himself up through the atmosphere. Why? I'll leave that, right? It's Acts chapter 1, and what are you going to do? But why does Jesus ascend. Heaven, surely, by today's standard, isn't, you know, it's not somewhere out past Mars or somewhere in the Oort cloud or whatever, right? Heaven is supposed to be this timeless, spaceless place. So I don't get the whole story. So I want to know from you guys, Darren, have you seen the videos that start including a spiritual song yet? Have you encountered those?
Not yet.
I think it's about week four or week five. Yeah, week four is the first one that opens with a song.
Okay, so one of the
I think a general comment on the videos, and I'd just like to just give a bit of credit, because I know this has been a complete pile-on fest for the last hour and a half. It'll probably continue that. So the quality, the production quality of the videos is pretty decent, and I'm quite impressed with that. Obviously, that doesn't carry on to the content, but I've found that the production quality of the videos has been quite decent. I've skipped forward through the songs because I'm just not interested in hearing a Christian song, to be quite honest. But even those bits, they're quite well done. They're quite well mixed. Use good use of video. The sound quality is decent.
That was the one thing I wrote down that I could compliment them on too.
That's the only one I thought that too. I think. Yeah, the production quality is great. They've got good scene cuts. One of the things that usually trips my ears when sound levels are uneven going from scene to scene, they've got great sound leveling. You know, they've got cute people, right? They managed to find pretty people for their videos. So yeah, oh, that's great. But here is a mind tampering thing that they start in week four, and I am absolutely against it. I think it's reprehensible. And so I'll just go ahead and put a pin in it. Matthew, what was week four? Is that Amazing Grace?
I haven't written down what each song was. Like I said, I skipped past the song. I'm just not interested in being sung at for 5 minutes.
Right. So one of the things that we know that music does is place people into a more suggestive kind of mood. And in fact, one of the universities out in Utah did some MRI studies of Mormons, kids at one of the Mormon schools. And they invited these kids to participate in these MRI studies to see what spirituality looked like in the brain. Okay. And we know that spiritual songs, or reading your favorite passage, or reciting certain kinds of verses, that kind of thing, they put us into this sort of, for lack of a better word, this sort of spiritual mindset, or at least in this very accepting kind of mindset. Some people might even call it transcendent, right? But we get this same kind of thing out of doing things like meditation or whatever. But my complaint is that putting these spiritual songs in is just a way to create a more accepting mindset so that you don't have to do the critical work of proving the claims that you're making. And so I object. And by the way, Matthew, I fast forward too. So there it is.
Any thoughts to add to that, Darren?
Not really. There is a reason why there's a lot of denominations of Christians that forbid people from listening to non-Christian music. As Andrew said, it's a very well-known ability to actually produce spiritual feelings in people. Music does. So that's why they forbid their congregation from listening to worldly music.
Oh, I am such a bad father. I let my daughter listen to Take That. But anyway, there we go. In my notes for week two, I've actually got down here that several of the people are on the call are impressed by the evidence that's been presented. And we've just talked for however long it is. absolutely slamming the quality of the evidence presented. So this probably feeds back to a question you asked earlier, Darren, about how people are responding to it. So people are clearly seeing these videos. So, and just for a setup, I'm going back to week one. I'm reading my notes. My notes are incomplete, but these are things that draw my attention at the time. In week one, very early on in the video, I've written that Nikki Gumbel, refers to the resurrection as the best attested fact in history. And I think that claim in itself can be challenged on multiple levels. And then in week two, there's also a segment saying that there's plenty of evidence that Jesus existed. Okay, maybe that's the case, but it says that just before running into textual criticism. And if you bear in mind what we said about textual criticism earlier, the claims of Jesus existing should be understood in the context of textual criticism. You know, they're not necessarily evidence he really existed. They're evidence that people said that Jesus existed. We don't know that they are actually true. And so you've got all that. And then we've got what we were talking about the resurrection. And then having listened to all of that, people become impressed by the evidence that's presented. So I think there's several things here. There are clearly some people who are watching this, and I've got to be careful what I'm saying, because I'm going to sound like I'm saying aren't I far more clever than these other people. But there are some people who see things like this and they get impressed by the way the word's being said, either because of the authority with which they're being said, or for one reason or another, their mind just isn't going to the critique, to the skeptical side of what they're listening to. Their mind just isn't engaging that question of how seriously should I take these words that I'm being told. And so with that combined with being impressed with what they're given, and they hear the word evidence, and then they hear these facts, and they assume they hear the word evidence, and then they hear these claims, and they assume that means that the claims are true, and they become impressed by the evidence. And then when that gets into the rest of the weeks, they're already convinced that Jesus is real and the resurrection really happened. But as I said before, the amount of evidence that's gone into is very, very weak. After week two, we don't really talk about evidence in the videos anymore. It's all straight into apologetic arguments and the convincing tactics. So I'm deeply disappointed by this. Am I being overly harsh, or is that fair?
I don't think you're being overly harsh. I mean, again, it goes back to what do we mean by evidence? Nothing that was presented in week two, I would consider evidence.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Nikki, you know, he starts out by, you know, establishing his bona fides. You know, he was the argumentative atheist. He's a barrister. And then, you know, he had these so-called logical arguments with Christians when they would bring it up. And then he reads the New Testament and is convinced it's true. I mean, that's his definition of evidence. You know, that's his, when he says he really examined the evidence, he just means he read the New Testament. And I don't know how, I mean, did anyone in either group pick that up, that when he was saying, oh, we have all this evidence, you know, all this stuff that shows it's true, I read the New Testament and I believed it. Did anyone pick up on that at all?
I didn't raise that specifically, or if I have, I haven't noted down that I read it, because I jumped straight to the textual criticism one, because that's the one that really jumped out for me from that week two video. And so I pushed on that and said that the conclusion was unsound because textual criticism is not a validation of the truth of documents. So I pushed that point.
I pushed textual criticism too, because it was what came to mind to talk about. And in week two, I went last. So I didn't get to shape the conversation. The conversation had already been shaped by the time it got to me. But so a couple of things about Nikki. First, I think they picked the right guy for this, right? He's a nice looking guy.
He's the guy that wrote it and founded the whole thing.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, he's also quite fortunate that he doesn't look like Shrek, right? but So he's a nice looking guy. He's got a pleasant delivery. He's clearly well educated and he's articulate. And he comes from this long line of barristers, which I interpret as lawyer. Is that right? I mean, he's a lawyer, right?
Yes.
Right. And he says, you know, it's such a long line of lawyers that if we'd had a cat, the cat would have been a barrister. And so he's clever. He's fun to listen to. I did point out in week two that I felt like there was an argument from authority, and he was it. That was the bit that I was referring to, because I don't particularly care what conclusion Nikki came to. If all he can say is, I'm a lawyer, I looked at the evidence, I come from a long line of evidence considerers, right? And I read the New Testament, and I find it to be appealing and life-changing, and therefore you should believe it. We should all reject that.
Trend with a certain brand of Christian where, you know, certainly those that weren't, like you and myself, weren't indoctrinated into Christianity as children, are those who became Christians as adults. And we see this on the Unbelievable Facebook group as well. And I've certainly in my Christian days, I've encountered this kind of Christian as well. I was a God-hating atheist, and then I found the Bible and I read the Bible, and now I'm a Christian. So if I can believe it, you don't need to question it. And right. You know, we need to reject that line of argumentation, because when we actually boil down what it is that they're saying, there isn't any substance there.
Yeah, and then he makes it worse by claiming that historical evidence isn't scientific, and science has nothing to say on historical evidence. So apparently he was never a criminal lawyer. He didn't do anything in
blood spatter or gunshots or that kind of thing. Yeah, where you run into real physical evidence.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just, whenever someone starts claiming that science has nothing to say on, they can say how the cake was made, but not who made it, I have to really wonder if they have ever even looked into what science is, because even like a 101 class in college would have disabused him of that ridiculous notion.
Right. Because surely if we were actually investigating a cake, investigating a cake is not, investigating the making of a cake is not much different than investigating, who committed a burglary, right? So it's like saying we can tell how the burglary was performed, but we can't tell who did the burglary. Well, that's sort of nonsense, isn't it? Where did you find the cake? Is just one tiny question that we would ask about deciding who made the cake, right? And we peel these layers, and eventually you find the person that has cake mix on their hands, and they have dirty dishes in their sink, and you find the person that made the cake. So I didn't think that was a particularly good argument either. It tells us how a thing was done, but not who wanted it done. But here's the real problem. If you can tell how something's done, but not who wanted it done, surely that's a weakness in Christianity.
Well, no, because they claim that the Bible tells them who did it. So, and because, you know, Nikki read the Bible and he decided it was true, obviously that means that the Bible is accurate. And yeah,
right. So yeah, it was bad all the way around. It was.
And then of course the evidences that Jesus existed were pretty bad too. No Christian scholar thinks that he wasn't a real person. I mean, we'll ignore apparently Richard Carrier, who is who is a historian, who's a Christian scholar, who doesn't think he actually existed. Apparently, Tacitus and Josephus wrote about Jesus,
That was. Come on.
Jesus was alive. Even though they also wrote about Hercules and Romulus and Grace.
I wanted to have time in week two to talk about Tacitus and Josephus, because it is almost as if the skeptical community has done better research than the Christians here, right? And Tacitus is the okay. Look,
I know.
Go ahead.
She even quoted the interpolation that even Christian scholars don't believe was originally in there, as if that was evidence.
Right. And so, listeners, just go look up Tacitus. Because Christians own the first page on Google, you'll probably have to swap to the second 10 links. But dig until you find counter apologetics about Tacitus, because it's so very bad. It's so very bad. Matthew, where are we on your list of?
Well, we've basically demolished the first 2 weeks. That's probably good enough for this episode, because after the first two episodes, so it really stops talking about evidence, starts talking about the substance of Christianity, the claims of Christianity. And I didn't want to move on to that in this recording, so that will be the next one. Those are a little bit more difficult to unpick. Not difficult is probably not the right word there, but they require a different way of thinking and a different kind of conversation to unpick those. So I'm quite happy to call it now on that one, with the and leave it at the evidence and the discussion around the format of the way the alphas run. So if there are any last points that you two want to raise.
I think the Alpha course, like we said, its production value is really well done, which is, it's actually sort of interesting, because a lot of Christian videos in the last, I want to say 5 or 10 years, the production quality has gotten really good. If you look at Christian videos 10 years or older, production quality is really, really bad. So they obviously fixed that. Now all they have to do is try to fix their arguments so that they're not just as bad as the production quality used to be.
Yeah. And I think for some people, good production quality equates to authority. So they're getting good value for their money, if you want to put it that way.
Oh, yeah. I even find myself falling into that trap. If there's a really good quality video and a really crappy quality video, I'm more likely to watch the good quality video over the crappy quality video, even if the crappy quality video has better information in it. I mean, I like to think that I'm a better at distinguishing the actual content, but I mean, it does play a part.
Yeah, and I think there's a lesson there for content providers.
Yeah, for sure. I just want to know, in the snarkiest possible way, why did Christians ever have poor production quality? They got the creator of the universe on their side.
Well, obviously they weren't taking notes very well.
It's interesting, sir, because I remember, again, back in my Christian days and having, in the early days of computing and having these kinds of conversations in small groups, and people would genuinely say, oh, it's just good enough to get it out. And I'll say, no, it's not good enough to get out. You've got to make it look good. And I remember conversations about the service notes that people would hand out, and they were typed on a typewriter. And I would say, no, don't do it on the typewriter. We've got a computer in the office. Use the word processor, use a font that's not Courier single space. And make the headings in a different font and make them bold and larger, and actually make the service leaflets interesting to look at before people even start reading the content. And I remember having these conversations with people 25 years ago, 30 years ago, even. That message and that attitude is clearly far more common now, but there very much used to be a case of, oh, it's just good enough to get it out. People will read it because they're on our side anyway. And I think enough people have realized that actually doesn't wash.
Well, and I think even though the production quality is quite good, and I readily admit it's quite good, I think the content is still sort of what you said, Matthew. The content is good enough to get it out because they're on our side anyway. And I think that's, and to demonstrate that, out of, well, we had 30, 35 people on week one, about the same on week two, you had 30 or 35. As far as I can tell, there are three atheists.
So, yeah, that's sort of interesting, because I got the impression from the first video that they were sort of targeting non-Christians in the course.
Yeah, that's clearly who they're trying to get. But I don't know what kind of people they're targeting at, because I'm clearly not the target audience, because there's been nothing whatsoever in any of the videos so far that has made me stop and go, I should think about that more seriously.
Oh, yeah, the content's so bad, there's no way they can... Well, I want to say there's no way they can actually be targeting non-believers, but... I mean, given what they think evidence is, maybe they are. I mean,
I think it's the testimonies. I think that is their secret weapon, is testimonies, which is why every video has a testimony. And in the small groups, there's lots of people talking about their personal experience. And there's often a question about, what do you think about this? And have you had any experiences of this? And I think the person that's going to go into the Christian mindset is much more likely to be swayed by somebody else's personal experience and testimony than they are by evidence.
You know, I would be convinced by personal testimony if the person having the testimony could demonstrate that what they're testimonying is what they're claiming is actually happened. But since they can't, and they never do, and it's always seems to come down to, oh, I just have this feeling. Yeah. Okay, well, I've got a dopamine spike too. That doesn't mean that Jesus exists.
And I think there's something precious about personal testimony. In one of the weeks, one of the recent weeks, I think it was last week, not this week, just gone. There was talk about experiences and things like that, and some people shared some really personal things. And then the leader asked, you know, what do people think about that? What's just been said? And people said things, and then it came to me. And I said, you know what, I'm actually reluctant to say anything skeptical about this, because people have shared some really personal stuff, and I would feel terrible if I come in with my size 10 boots and just stomp all over what they've just said.
Yeah, so you're a much nicer person than I am.
Thank you. But, you know, I think that's what it is. You know, people hear a testimony, and even if they're like me and they're not believing it in secret, they're not demolishing it in public. And so the person there who's listening, who needs to hear something critical, isn't getting that critical.
That's been so early in this episode, I complained that the group leader was adopting a Christian with voodoo in her background into the Christian tent. And this is often my complaint about Christianity, is that when it suits, when the conditions are right, Christianity will adopt any story without challenge, as long as it has the label Christian. And then, you know, you start getting Christians to try to defend their actual doctrinal positions. They'll get quite irate with each other. But there's not a tradition, as far as I can tell, or at least not a healthy tradition, of asking people to back their spiritual claims. So, okay, I see Mary on a piece of toast. Well, it's not my fault that it's real. And that thing sold for like $10,000 or something. It's quite ridiculous. She would have been better off making penicillin out of it. But the thing is, these are the kinds of stories that just get accepted. So I know that one's pretty ridiculous and we can all laugh at it, but my point is that in these small groups, I would have expected some Christian with a little bit of incredulousness to say, okay, right. Voodoo and Christianity, I don't exactly see how that goes together, right? Where is the voice in Christianity that challenges the wild claims it's not there enough because the whole story, in my view, is built on wild claims.
Yeah, once you start introducing magic and a creator of the universe, I mean, how wild is a talking donkey, really? I mean, yeah. It's...
hey, and
you know what? It's weird hearing people openly mock the talking donkey story now that I'm past 50 and looking at. But there was a time in my life when I took that story really, really seriously.
And the talking serpent. By the way, not just the talking serpent, the walking talking serpent. Because his curse was not to stop him from talking, although that apparently had happened too, but the curse for the serpent in the garden was to cause him to wriggle on his belly in the dust.
Okay, question for you on that point, Andrew. And we're going a little bit off topic here, so we're clearly in the wind-up. The writer of those early chapters of Genesis says the devil took the form of a serpent, but the person who wrote it at the time of writing it, for them a serpent would have been a creature that crawled along its belly. But he writes it took the form of a serpent, and then after that the serpent gets cursed to crawl along on its belly. What did the serpent look like before that curse? What does, in that pre-curse language, what does the form of a serpent mean in reality?
So, sort of halfway through there, my internet connection dodged you a little bit. Ask
probably
that question
best.
One more time. No, you can't do it now. Go ahead.
If I say to you, the devil took the form of a serpent, you imagine probably something like an anaconda. I imagine it's probably the kind of thing that you imagine. But that's sure. Something that's already crawling on its belly. The phrase in Genesis, which says the devil took the form of a serpent or whatever it is that it says, is pre-curse, before it's been cursed to crawl along on its belly. So what does the pre-curse form of a serpent look like?
You know, I've asked myself that question, and this probably does
and
tie in.
And did those people reading it understand that as well?
You know, I don't know, but I think this does actually tie in, because this is part of the evidence that we've been, or lack of evidence that we've been talking about. So I think it might be useful to go through this exercise. I've often asked myself what a pre-fall, before Genesis 3:15, walking, talking serpent would look like. And if it didn't look like a human, Adam and Eve weren't enough like me for me to find value in their story, and here's why. As far as I can tell, we have these experiences of walking, talking beings as being only us. And in the Garden of Eden, all of the other animals, and we don't have stories of talking deer, or talking antelope, or talking crustaceans, or whatever else was in the garden, and Adam and Eve could surely see each other, right? And so, this serpent, if it looks anything like a serpent, but it's walking around on two legs, so some sort of a two-legged reptile, as for instance, and they just treat it as if it's equal to them. And that doesn't seem to be what humans really do. If I came upon a talking dog, maybe that's a bad example. Pick any two-legged alien form. If I came upon a talking alien, I think I would treat it with some amount of reserve, right? I wouldn't just say, okay, well, this God over here that I think created me said, don't eat of the tree. And you say, oh yeah, it's perfectly fine. So I'll just take your advice. Right. And so I don't know what this talking serpent looked like, but if I'm going to take the Adam and Eve story, remotely seriously, I think it had to look human. Because Adam and Eve treat it as if it's human.
Okay, they certainly don't seem to be surprised by this thing that's described as a form of a serpent approaching them and talking to them. There's right. no expression of that. You know, it just all lends itself to the incredulity of the story once you start to pick apart these little details.
Right. Now, maybe you say, if I just woke up one day and, there's only me and Eve and this other talking thing, maybe that's just naturally part of my world. And so I don't have any natural reserve that we might have today because we don't have the same kind of environment. But it still doesn't answer your question. What does a pre-Genesis 3:15 walking, talking serpent look like? I don't know. The best I can do is some sort of two-legged reptile.
I wonder if the question is sort of coming at the problem differently than it originally had. Because a lot of mythology like that is sort of designed to explain why things exist the way they do. And can you think of anything else besides a snake that doesn't have four limbs of some sort?
A lizard? Lizards
have legs, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if they saw everything else that had limbs of some sort, legs, whatever. Fish had fins, and then they had this thing that's a serpent. And someone asked, "Well, how did that? Why does that have no legs?" And then they sort of start spinning this tale of, "Oh, well, in the Garden of Eden, it was the thing that tempted Adam and Eve, and therefore God cursed it without to remove all its limbs."
So just retrofitting the story.
Yeah, and there are things like that for all sorts of animals. There are legends over how zebras got their stripes. There are legends over how the elephant got its long trunk. You know, these kinds of things that are standout features of animals have their own origins, legends of how they ended up the way they are. Well, there's even a story about the bird, you know, the bird that goes into the crocodile's mouth to pick out its meat. There's even a story about that, and there's a story about the hippo. So for those that don't know, the way hippos defecate is, say, they're in the river and they wag their tiny little stumpy tail really, really hard, and they spread their defecation as it exits their body, so it spreads in a mucky, stinky splat into the water, and you genuinely don't want to be anywhere near that when it's going on. And there's a whole legend around why the hippo does that. So any animal that has something that's unique and stand out about it has an origins legend around how that particular feature came about. None of them are true, obviously.
But... Right. Well, right. And surely in the area where the Garden of Eden was supposed to have been, so we've got the Tigris and the Euphrates, that sort of area. They didn't have things like eels, right, which aren't snakes. But if they'd seen sea creatures that didn't have legs, they might have just thought of them all as snakes, because they don't have or didn't have the kind of biology that we have today that gives us sort of genus and species and phylum and all of that kind of thing. And so, Darren, I think I'm inclined to agree that the story is just a retrofit. This snake must be the cause of all of our problems.
Well, and we have we're sort of biologically hardwired to fear snakes too.
We are absolutely, and it's. And I've been, of growing up in Zambia, I've seen this, and monkeys and our other tree-dwelling cousins, they are utterly terrified of snakes. Snakes are a genuine threat, and if they hear a snake, their cry is very distinct and very, very panicked, and it's very different to the kind of call where if a feline predator comes into their space, or even if there's a bird of prey flying above, the snake call is something very, very different. And it terrifies them, and the same way snakes terrify indigenous African populations as well. And it's very much associated with the devil and with evil and that kind of thing. So it's not difficult to imagine how that kind of biological response results in the kind of story that we have in Genesis 1,
yeah,
or whatever chapter it is.
So the problem, just to put a bow on this as we wind to a close, the problem is telling a story prior to the evidence, right? And our, we can tell a story and think that we're right about it and just refuse to move from that position. So this snake is the root of all of our problems or whatever. But a skeptic should be very, very comfortable, should require herself to become comfortable with the notion of not having an answer and of being willing to wait for an answer as long as necessary to be able to tell a story that is at least possible, right? And as far as the Alpha Course goes, I haven't seen a story that was told that is in fact even possible. And yeah, it starts at Genesis 1.
Thank you. Final thoughts from anyone?
That was mine.
As far as the Alpha Course goes, I'm very dubious at this point. And if you're correct, and this is the only even attempt at evidence that they've tried at week 2, I'm guessing the rest of it is just mostly going to be theodicies. And do they even get into any of the philosophical arguments for God, or is it mostly just feelings and personal testimony and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's mostly feelings and testimony. There is no analysis, or certainly nothing more than a superficial analysis of arguments. From memory, I don't think any of the philosophical arguments for God are even mentioned in any of the videos. They might come up in some of the groups, but I think the average layperson just can't handle them. But I'm thinking about it, I'm surprised they don't, actually, because you'd have thought that the average layperson could be quite easily convinced by them, possibly more easily convinced by those than by the dubious references to evidence.
Well, it's sort of interesting.
Yeah, so I'm disappointed. I'm very disappointed by what Alpha has delivered to me.
Well, it's sort of interesting because people don't actually need strong reasons to believe something. They just need something that's good enough that they can sort of use as sort of a password, if you will, or a catchphrase, so that they don't actually... that they think is accurate and they don't really have to think about. And I wonder if that's the niche that Alpha Course sort of fills. It gives them those reasons that are just good enough and then sort of points them to other apologetics if they need more.
Yeah.
Well, and they do mention, both of you will have seen this, I think, they do mention companion reading each week. They give a book each week that can go along with each video. But while I have read a couple of the books, not at the time of offering in the Alpha Course, but in previous reading, while I've read some of the material, I've not run across a single Christian yet in Alpha who has done the companion reading. And so that's a little disappointing.
Right. Well, with demolishment done, thank you both. We will convene again at some point in a couple of weeks to talk about the next few videos of Alpha. If Darren can cope with it, he'll appear again. Andrew and I will definitely be here. Hopefully Tony will be along to join us as well. By the time we talk again, it's very possible I might have finished my Alpha, so I might have to just go back and refresh on some of the videos, because I've only got 2 videos and meetings of Alpha left for mine. So I'm definitely in the wind down stage. Andrew's about halfway through. Tony's still at the very beginning. So thank you, listeners, for listening. If you've got thoughts on what we've just done, and I did warn you right at the beginning that it was going to be very critical all the way through. Any thoughts on that? Reasonpress@gmail.com is the email address. Have you done Alpha? Do you agree with our assessment? Do you disagree with our assessment? I'd genuinely be interested to hear from you if you disagree. Are you a Christian who thinks that we've really done a bad job here and you think that Alpha deserves a defense? Come on, let's that wasn't a challenge for a fight the way I said that. Come on, let's have a conversation about that and tell us where you think we've gone wrong and we can unpack that. Thank you, guys. It's 11 o'clock for me in the evening, so I need to disappear. And we will talk to you guys again. Thanks very much for the conversation. You have been listening to a podcast by Reason Press. To get in touch, email reasonpress@gmail.com or see our website, reasonpress.net, where you'll also find our book, Still Unbelievable. We welcome all feedback and you might even end up on an episode. Our theme music was written for us by Holly. You can hear more of her music at soundcloud.com/hollybishop. You can support us by buying some of Holly's music and telling her we sent you.